You know, as CMOs, we have a shorter lifespan than everyone, right? We're the most expendable because it's such a subjective territory in a lot of ways. So you kind of have to become a road warrior to some degree. I was in San Francisco after New York. Then we moved to Miami for Crispin. Then I was fortunate enough to be able to stay in Miami for my first CMO job. But then it was up to Pennsylvania. Now it's DC. It's whiplash, right?
Yeah. Well, you're also a world citizen. Your mantra is move, move and groove. Hey, it's EB Moss, and this is episode 24 of Insider Interviews, where you get the insider scoop on the business of media, marketing, and advertising, from CMOs to CEOs. Now, you know when there's someone you admire and maybe you're a little wowed by them, maybe because that person has worked on everything from Apple to Absolute and has been a CMO of some really big brands, but then you meet that person and you feel like you made a new best friend? Well, I bet a lot of people feel that way about Kim Wickstrom, but I'm still claiming him as my new friend. He's a marketer, humanist, and a lover of brands. He's been on the agency side and the client side, from Perry Ellis to now Vanda Pharmaceuticals. I think his charisma might come from having been a world citizen, or maybe from his one-eyed cat named Gibson. But take a listen and see if you don't feel like he's your very smart friend, too. So, Kim.
Yes.
Because you've lived all over and you've been on both sides of the track, so to speak, you know, sometimes I sing on my podcast. So you get, I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere.
That's awesome. That's fantastic.
Thank you. I've embarrassed myself more times than I can recall. But, you know, for you, anything. Kim Wickstrom. You are now the SVP and Chief Marketing Officer of Vanda Pharma.
Correct.
Vanda Pharmaceuticals? Vanda Pharma.
Vanda Pharmaceuticals, yeah.
Okay, so we'll be formal. We'll stretch it out. Mm-hmm. But man, you worked on Think Different for Apple to Lending Done Human for One Main Financial. Mm-hmm. You worked on Vodka, now Pharma. Mm-hmm. You've been on the agency side, the client side.
Yeah.
Wow, you make a schizophrenia drug. It is that like too much?
I didn't take it there.
Sorry.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it's twofold. It's nature and nurture, right? So, in some ways, nature in the sense that I grew up in a lot of different places. So, and I guess from being born in West Africa as a Swedish kid in the 60s. Then moving to Sweden in the 70s, then moving to the US in the 80s, and you kind of develop kind of a cultural curiosity just by nature, by having been put through those kinds of changes, right? And then I think on top of that, you have the nurture of, you know, mom and her interests, the school you go to, the teachers that inspire you, that kind of thing. And with that, I guess I've always had kind of a liberal artsy humanities kind of inclination, I guess is more the word. And I recall when I started at Georgetown University that, you know, all my friends were in the School of Foreign Service and were taking classes like, you know, Interballistic Missile Strategy 101 and the Russia problem and things like that. And, you know, they thought they were so smart, so serious, and used to make fun of me coming home with my textbooks from, you know, the history of the Gothic Cathedral or whatever, you know.
You were an art history major, right?
Yeah, or sort of Wordsworth, the Prelude, or whatever it was, because I really was a full-on liberal artsy kind of student. But I think that to me, it's being curious about life and being curious about culture and sort of being an omnivore in a lot of ways. I think advertising lends itself naturally to someone who is that interested in, you know, how we shape and creatively express our worldview, how we understand the things around us, how perceptions are shaped. And so I think it made sense for me to land there. But then as it turns out, of course, you know, I'm half a humanist, half a, you know, something that's more analytical. Perhaps I was never going to be the next Leonardo. You know, my heroes growing up were, my idols growing up were Kiss. I was never going to be Paul Stanley or Gene Simmons. And so, you know, you figure out the way to take whatever you're equipped with and put it to use where maybe it is best applied. I think advertising was a natural place for me. You know, marketing on the client side also makes sense because you have to have both. You have to have a little bit of the analytical, you have to have a little bit of the strategic, but you must be a humanist, basically.
Yes. So this is all gelling for me now. We met because I'm the editor of a publication and you were one of the first contributors to it. It's called The Continuum. And the intent of it is to create industry conversation around the marriage, if you will, of brand and demand marketing, of awareness marketing and performance marketing, and that it shouldn't be one or the other. And you wrote one of the best performing pieces in there talking about how it starts with this story, y'all. You know, stop starting with the tactics and what you called the silver bullets, which we'll get to. But all of this makes sense because I can tell you're a storyteller. You have the sort of multi-pronged life experience, and that's what you apply, it seems, to your brand skills. Can you describe your point of view about storytelling first?
Sure. I mean, I think maybe one of the most simplistic ways of looking at it is looking at a movie, perhaps, right? So you may have amazing cinematography or incredible effects, but if the movie sucks, the movie sucks. And fundamentally, why does the movie suck? It is if the story doesn't hold. If the story isn't there to pull it all together, all those other technical elements, you know, they may be effective in a sense, but what's going to be the takeaway, right? Not that strong. I think that's the best allegory for something like this. There are movies where everything clicks, where you have the right actors, you have the right story, you have the right cinematography. Of course, those are rare. Not everything is an Orson Welles kind of masterpiece, but you have a lot of Wes Anderson movies that are brilliant, for example. And it's because you fundamentally start with what is it you're trying to tell? What's the story you're trying to tell? And then how is it best told? It's the second part. And I think way too often, because we're so enamored with, you know, right now we're in the middle of CES in Vegas. All everyone wants to talk about is how you have these new technological solutions to everything. You can now have your car tell you that you're low on milk because your refrigerator is smart, you know?
Yeah.
And it's coupled with your car and so on and so forth. Okay, great. But are you going to buy the refrigerator based on that? I don't know. Do you think it's a quality refrigerator? What is the point behind having that? So to me, there's so much emphasis on the bells and whistles, forgetting about basically what it is you're trying to do. And that's also why it sort of offends me a little bit, this whole sort of demand or brand, because what marketing is not about performance. Fundamentally, all marketing is for performance purposes, right? What's the objective of marketing? It is to grow your market share, to grow your product somehow or other, and to grab people's attention enough that they would be interested in your product or your whatever it is you're marketing. So if you're going to try to grab people's attention for something that you want them to pay attention to, you probably need to start with what is it we're trying to say and why would it be compelling to people, as opposed to just the method by which you can deliver the message. The thing that everyone focuses on in the last decade or so are all the DTC companies, for example, you know, your Warby Parkers and so on and so forth. But the product there is the story. That is the story, how they make that product. It's great design, so on and so forth. So it's sort of baked into what Warby Parker is. And that's what I mean. Then how you deliver that, you can do that in any gazillion different ways, but focusing only on the performance or sort of the silver bullet solution misses kind of the point of what marketing is, I think.
So this applies universally. I mean, you've worked in a lot of different verticals, as you know, I teased in the beginning, you were at everything from Perry Ellis to now pharmaceutical. You were on the agency side working on everything from VW to, as we mentioned, Absolut. So it doesn't matter. You have to tell the story first. You have to build the brand. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's an obsession with metrics and attribution, which is not wrong per se. I mean, of course, you need to understand if it's working or not. But oftentimes, there's an obsession that sort of misses the point entirely. It's really all about the ROI as opposed to, can you see if it's working? If people are talking about your TV spot, that, for example, and I probably sound ancient focusing on a TV spot, but I mean, that's the point. If people are talking about it or care about it or have a positive reaction to it somehow or other, then that's probably more important than any sort of little blip of metrics. I think we waste so much time over analyzing and over programming everything.
So you're trying to elicit emotion from a story.
Yeah.
And you said once in an interview that the levers, the tactics, like whatever the shiny toy is part of the mix, but it starts when you articulate your brand story. What's the story of Vanda? What did you inherit?
So Vanda is very interesting. It's a very small but innovative pharmaceutical company. And what I inherited was quite a legacy, actually, because the founder of the firm is very much a cerebral, you know, intellectual and culturally curious person. So he is very interested in the creativity aspect of telling stories, which was interesting because, you know, I didn't really have any kind of inclination of going to pharma because, you know, my perception of pharma was not that it was particularly interesting from a marketing perspective. But I was convinced otherwise. And I think the first campaign I got the good fortune to work on with Mihalis was for Fanapt, which is our schizophrenia drug. And it's quite delicious. I mean, it was already formed more or less when I got there. But it's very inspired by pop art.
So did you influence that? Was that style already created? And if so, how did you move it forward? Because it's really op pop. It's quite the sight.
It was already in place. So that idea had already been developed, which I thought was fantastic. The challenge, I guess, I got to be part of was, okay, well, how do you translate that now into a TV spot or into other areas of storytelling? So we looked at many different paths for doing that. And I think we ended up in a way of, you know, not being literal to the concept, but sort of bringing the concept to life in a different way.
And what's an example of something that you innovated? What's a kind of cool tool that you got to use to continue the storytelling?
So one of the areas that we've gone into now is more online as well. So the website itself, I participated in, but more beyond that is kind of the online advertising. And that's been really, really fun to see how you can take this concept and again, the parts don't look exactly the same. The TV doesn't look exactly the same, but it's the same characters. It's the same story extended into different spaces. There are different ways of seeing the same thing, basically, which is kind of fascinating because it doesn't need to be homogenous to make sense, which I think is one of the things with you don't have to necessarily make it all linear for the story to make perfect sense.
But you are a little hamstrung by having to enable disclosures and things like that with pharmaceutical, yeah?
I mean, it was one of the hesitations I had originally was the fact that you're in such a box creatively, and the FDA really puts you in a terrible squeeze. I mean, it's very hard to be creative given the way they box you in. Mm. But I mean, that's also a challenge then, right? I mean, then you have to kind of try to figure out how you work around it. It's interesting though, because in some ways you could argue that it's a tax on pharma because half of the spot has to go to all the disclosures of every possible thing that could ever maybe hypothetically go wrong. Which it is what it is, but it's frustrating.
And one other thing is that with Vanda Pharmaceutical, you had to learn to speak science. You're still learning.
I'm still learning. It's still a lot of Well, I say Greek. The founder, my boss, is Greek, but it's a lot of Greek to me.
Yeah. Wow.
And then, you know, what I always used to hate about pharma too is the naming, right? I mean, the names on drugs are ridiculous.
It's sort of like a racehorse where it gets a part of this parent and a part of that parent. How does that work?
It's because the name has to be unique and it has to be not signifying anything. It can't imply effectiveness or curative qualities. So it has to be something completely made up, because otherwise they're going to claim that it suggests it might make you or stronger or more handsome or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good Brainiac would not be a good legal name to use.
No. Prevagen for your brain. I got to start taking Prevagen.
Stuff. Is that the memory thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Pass some over. So you have the Kim brand, which is, it starts with storytelling and then you layer in things. How did you arrive at that? What was the path that you took to form your point of view and had to get there?
Yeah, no, I think I really cut my teeth on two clients, on two campaigns that, apart from the baggage I came with and what I like to do, I learned a lot from Absolut Vodka and that classic campaign and from Steve Jobs on Apple. So I was really lucky. When I started at Chai Day, I got the opportunity to first work on Absolut Vodka, but I also got the opportunity to work on Apple when Apple came back to TBWA after Steve Jobs returned to Apple. And that was the launch of the now iconic Apple campaign, Think Different. And, you know, I was a junior person at TBWA then, so I'm not claiming any credit whatsoever for the campaign. The point was that I was on the launch team, and I got the opportunity to go to Cupertino a couple of times and be part of the launch and figuring out how we would, you know, expand the circles of the campaign beyond the US, for example. Apple was run from LA, from the LA office, and I was in New York. But being in New York, we were the closest to Latin America. We got to run Latin America. Okay, figure out how to run Latin America for Apple. That was my remit.
Wow.
And part of that
became... And this is Apple or Absolut?
Apple.
Oh, wow.
So I had to figure out, like, what agencies could we work with? How do we do this? How do you translate this to Portuguese and Brazil? How do you, whatever, you know, all that kind of stuff. But when I did that, and I was simultaneously working on the Absolut Vodka account, Absolut Vodka said, well, we're also a global client. What do you mean you're going to go to Latin America and help Apple figure out how to do it? We need Latin America too. So I got Absolut and Apple to go figure out how to do in Latin America. And that was a blast. That was really, really fun.
I bet. And the travel bug was satisfied a little bit that way.
For sure. But what was really, really amazing with that was actually encountering Steve Jobs and seeing the process by which that campaign came about. And that was a ton of learnings about what actually really matters. He couldn't give a crap about ROI or metrics, frankly. Uh-huh. I mean, basically, the simple answer there was, you can see what works. Here's my point of view. And this is a strong point of view. And if people react to it, that's what matters. You can think of any Microsoft advertising through the ages, and it's hard to see how it made anyone care any way, which way or another.
Right.
Whereas with Apple, clearly, obviously, you see the work of brand. Mm. And they sell a lot of product. So it's not like brand doesn't work in selling or performance. It's the most valuable company in the world. So that was one of the things I thought, you know, that was an aha experience learning from him that rules are A, not necessarily meant to be followed. You can make up your own path. B, storytelling through brand is what matters because people are attracted to it. C, then, of course, now in retrospect, also seeing that there's a lot of performance associated with that. Obviously, you can sell a lot of product with having an attractive brand. It brings people to the table. Absolut Vodka was exactly the same. There was never a question when we worked on that brand during the time that I worked on it about performance in the US. It was, of course, at that time in the US mainly print. It was a print-based campaign. It was all back covers. It was all about creativity. It was all about culture. That's what the brand stood for. And it was in sort of an empty signifier. You know, vodka is essentially odorless and tasteless. And this was a see-through bottle also. So what is it but sort of a little bit of a cultural signifier, if you will? So you have to fill it with something. And it became pretty much a signifier for fashion, for culture, for everything like that. And I mean, if you do print ads, it takes time to build momentum. But every year, sales grew. We didn't go worrying about the daily metrics on anything, but every year, sales grew and revenue grew, so on and so forth. So it was incredibly successful. And that's where I think in the foundation, I learned the value of brand to build a business.
So two things there. As a loyal New York Times subscriber, I always enjoyed the little blow-ins that I would get from Absolute. Were you responsible for that little Christmas sweater from my vodka bottle that I got one year, which I still have?
That was during my time on the Opposite Vodka campaign. Yes, exactly.
I love it. Still have it.
What's a traditional Father's Day gift? It's a tie in the shape of Absolute bottles.
Yeah. So that was an insert in the New York Times. And the other thing that story speaks to, when you said, you know, you weren't worried about the day in and day out of the numbers and everybody, you know, at their computer checking the minute by minute results of things and the click-throughs and this and that. And very similar to the way you described it with Apple. And I think that is part of the problem today, right? Is we have no patience. We have no belief in the long tail experience.
Right. I mean, I'm now speaking from when I was on the agency side. So I'm hoping that I'm not a bad client based on my agency experience with other clients. I've had clients, for example, who had called me and said, hey, we need to have a Facebook presence. Okay. And we need to have by end of next month, 250,000 followers. Okay. First question is why? What's the point? And second question is, okay, what are you trying to say? What are you trying to communicate through that channel? Because ultimately, again, story, right? I mean, if you're going to put up a Facebook page and you want followers, you have to offer them some compelling reason to want to engage with you. And what is that story? You can't just say, I want to have a, you can buy Facebook followers, but then those are bots, right? And what's the point?
So what are good KPIs then these days? And how much time do you give yourself to hit any of those key performance indicators?
Good question and tricky. I think to me, the stuff that actually really matters is if people care. You know, most people are exposed to, you know, thousands of messages, commercial messages every day, regardless of how you try to avoid them. You are somehow or other found. The enemy of marketing is indifference. And indifference is really where ROI goes to die. Because if you can't engage or compel some kind of interest in your product, whether positive or negative, then you've completely lost. It goes a little bit to that debate about sort of, you know, half of my advertising is wasted. I just don't know which half.
Yeah.
Turns out that it depends on how you measure, of course. There's lots of research to suggest that if your advertising is halfway good, that wasted advertising may actually be more valuable than you think. Because if it changes your opinion, if you care about something, it's actually going to end up making the difference. And that's what brand is, ultimately, right?
It almost sounds like the Mae West line instead of the John Wanamaker line. You know, don't worry what they say as long as they're talking about you in not too many words.
Because, you know, people are looking for the direct attribution. In a lot of stuff that we do, there's no direct attribution, right? And if you look at something as simple as Coke, for example, the growth in Coke comes from not your loyal buyers, but the person who occasionally picks up some Coke when in the supermarket. Why do they do that? Because they have a positive association with Coke. Okay, positive association, what does that mean? That's brand.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, it speaks to you. And I don't know if you remember that book, Biology.
B-U-Y.
B-U-Y, Biology. Yes, exactly. Great book. And it basically a summary of a ton of research done on fMRI tests on consumers.
And fMRI is?
Putting people into one of those MRI machines.
Oh. So literally seeing like your biorhythmic response to something.
Exactly. And more importantly, looking at your brain and your brain waves reacting to stuff. So the book Biology summarizes fMRI studies in consumers to see how their brain waves reacted to brands, basically. And among other things, one of the things I thought was most interesting, they proved that the Pepsi challenge was correct. Meaning that in a blind taste test, you prefer Pepsi. The vast majority of people prefer Pepsi because it's sweeter, right? But if you introduce the notion of the brand, if you put the Coke bottle there versus the Pepsi bottle, you can see in the fMRI machine, the brain waves, the pleasure centers light up like a Christmas tree. Why is that? Mm-hmm. That's because people have these positive associations with Coke. And that's why Pepsi can never win.
Wow. All right. So now I'm going to play a little hardball with you.
No.
Yes, I know. You're tough enough for it, Kim. Emotional responsiveness, storytelling, wah, wah, wah. But what are the silver bullets that we should be adding on to things? What are your favorite tools once you've got the story down? Because I know that you're not truly dismissive of all of these tools and tactics. So when you're telling a good story, what do you use to amplify it? What do you use to drive performance tactically?
On a tactical level, I'm still a believer in direct marketing of different forms, whether it be digital or mail, believe it or not. And with One Main Financial, for example, you know, the vast majority of our marketing was direct mail. To me, the point of brand in the mix is it's going to amplify your ability to get pull through on those tactical pieces. Because if people receive something in the mail, whether email or online, whatever, it's really easy, of course, to dismiss it and throw it out. If you have a brand, it's not as easy. They may actually open it. They may actually open the email. They may actually open the mail, right? So it basically primes demand. That's what brand does. And then you capture that demand through those tactical performance, quote unquote, tactics, whether it be direct mail, email, online, social media, for example. I've fallen for the social media thing myself a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, you know, direct messaging, but it's been presented in a brand story-like way that I found compelling.
Well, I mean, that opens up a whole other discussion about specific tactics, and we won't go down the path of the good or evil of social media. A lot of people are no longer speaking through Parler and Twitter and things like that. So social media is iffy, but that also brings up aspects of the brand that are important emotional triggers. And that is social responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So social media might be having not such a great day, but social responsibility, I think, is increasingly important to consumers. Am I right?
Totally agree. I couldn't agree more. And I think, there are so many aspects to social responsibility, whether it's about environmental responsibility or governance or inclusion and diversity. No, I mean, I think all those things are really, really key. I think we're in a strange place culturally right now, because on the one hand, we seem to be going two steps forward, one steps back, or maybe it's one step forward and two steps back.
Mm-hmm.
There's a serious tension in culture around this, and apparently also creating kind of a chasm between different parts of our, at least American society, right? One step forward in one place creates resentments in other places, causing a backlash. I mean, not to be too literal, but I think that that's a little bit of the reaction we've been seeing around us, which is a little bit frightening, to be honest.
Yeah. And along those lines, I listened to an interview with you from maybe 2.5, 3 years ago. And you said then, and asked for predictions, that AI might be a slippery slope that could isolate us in our own echo chamber.
Yeah.
Okay. So it looks like that dangerous path that you predicted is starting to come to fruition. How can we break out of our own echo chambers and, humanize again?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I wish I had the answer to it. But I mean, you look at something like video games, to just pick one of those sort of AI-related areas. I think it's the third largest form of distributed entertainment out there. It's a giant industry. Yeah. And so many young people are growing up isolated within that fantasy world. And of course, I think, not to get too political, but clearly we have a divided media universe. And so we live in kind of separate parts of America to some degree too. It's a real issue. I think part of it has to be schools. Part of it has to be parents. Part of it has to be that society has to take some sort of ownership of truth versus fiction. There has to be accountability in order for us to kind of break the silos down.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to bring it back to the future, so to speak.
Yeah.
And speaking of the word break, now, given all of this, should someone want to break into marketing? Mm-hmm. Any advice? And here's the other big question. What do they need to know, Kim? Because you have to know tools, technology, strategy. If you're going to be a CMO, you have to know ad tech and marketing stacks or vice versa. So what's your advice?
I think if I look at my own path, I majored in art history and English lit, and that is only a reflection of my sort of cultural curiosity and sort of liberal artsy leanings. I think that general leaning is a good place to start if you're interested. It's also good to have right brain, left brain. So if you have some analytical abilities, given how obsessed we are with analytics and metrics, that is good as well. In order to break in, I think there's a couple of things you need to do. One good place to start is an advertising agency, frankly, still, even though there's all the talk about the death of particularly the big agency, mm-hmm. but it's a great place to learn on others' businesses and to understand the importance of storytelling and brand strategy in the mix of how you get to marketing, right? So I think it's a really, really great place to kind of get that education. You can, of course, get an MBA as well, which I did too, but that doesn't necessarily lend yourself immediately to getting the job. Finally, I think, and this may be the most important thing I've learned since leaving advertising, in advertising, you're sort of always 24/7. You know, you're never not on, if you will. And particularly if you want to be in a great advertising agency like Crispin. I mean, this was one of the amazing things about that place was the kind of energy, the kind of commitment you had to put in. You have to want to do that, you know, and if you're not willing to work, then don't go there. And unfortunately, something I've seen as a CMO is oftentimes I want to find and mentor new kids coming in and help them, but they also have to want it. They have to want to work and they have to want to learn. And the challenge is often that they have very high ambitions, but not as high work ethic standards, I guess. And I think that is one thing that I would advise someone going into it. If you're willing to work and you have a high work ethic, you can really make it in marketing. And a great place to start is advertising.
Excellent. Is there one last vertical that you would want to work in? You've done so many.
That's a great question. I mean, I love travel. I have worked with Cunard, but it could be fun to, once we get back to actually traveling again.
Yeah.
It would be really fun to either do the marketing for a destination, like who wouldn't love to market Italy or something like that, you know?
Yeah. So when you do that, can I have the friends and family discount?
Absolutely. Anytime.
Okay. Kim Wickstrom, thank you so much for joining me on Insider Interviews. It's been a roundabout way to get here and a lot of fun.
Thanks, Evie. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry if I was so forgetful late on a Friday afternoon.
It's A-OK. You're going to sound brilliant, I tell you. Awesome. I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and let me know if you have a question or suggestion for a next guest. My theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable and Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. And thanks again for listening.